welcome to the latest edition of the BRC's Trade Policy Podcast. This week, we have quite a lot to cover. The headline news is, of course, that the deadline for the extension to the UK-EU transition period has now passed. It is now confirmed that the UK will be leaving the single market and the customs union on the 1st of January next year. At the same time, negotiations are intensifying between the UK and the EU. Meanwhile, developments are likely on border processes, both in Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It's looking like it's going to be quite a busy summer in Brussels and also in Whitehall. I'm joined today, as ever, by the BRC's Trade Policy Advisor, William Bain. William, how are you going?
Hi there. Hope you're well.
I am. And also joined by the NIRC's Director, Aidan Connolly, to look at life after the transition period. Hello there, Aidan.
Hello. I'm still here.
So, William, starting with you, UK-EU talks have resumed face-to-face now and in smaller groups. Will that make any difference in resolving issues like state aid, in which there are still big barriers to any agreement in time for the autumn?
Well, it's hoped to. Certainly from the high-level summit, which the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson had with David Sassoli, Ursula von der Leyen and Charles Michel, three of the EU institutions presidents. The intention is really to intensify and really get going in July to try and get a sort of outline of what an agreement could look like. So that really does mean almost sort of abandoning some of these opening positions, which is what we've seen in the first 3 months of the negotiations, and really trying to come up with some alternatives that might meet the concerns of the other side. So that there's an element of empathy in trying to find a solution. Some of the issues, it's awkward. I mean, on state aid, I think the EU does have a big concern that the UK could become a kind of manufacturing hub offshore in terms of the European continent. Sort of pump priming domestic industries and, making some advantage of the generous rules of origin to export tariff-free goods into the EU with, much more advantageous production methods than might be available to the EU. So I think that is a major concern, and the UK is going to have to try and find something in terms of common standards and common principles that could be written into the agreement to try and deal with this. Again, from the UK's perspective, the government has made it a red line that it does not want to remain in lockstep with EU rules on state aid. It doesn't want to have European Court of Justice jurisdiction at all. So that's something that the EU is going to have to try and take account of. So I think common principles and standards that are referred to in the agreement and would be the baseline of policy from both sides would seem to be perhaps a way forward. The importance of this is the key that unlocks the door to the level playing field being resolved. That is the key to getting a zero tariff, zero quotas deal. So that's why in the BRC, we spend as much time as we do looking at these issues, because it's basically the key to getting the deal which ultimately retailers will want and will benefit consumers the most. In terms of some of the other issues that have got to be resolved, there are some important ones for retailers on rules of origin. So the UK wants to have a system under this trade agreement where qualifying material from other free trade agreements, which both it and the EU have made, can all be accumulated into qualifying material that meets the thresholds for that to receive zero tariff treatment. And again, the EU has some concerns here because it wonders whether the UK might take advantage of this to undercut production within the European Union and give the UK a considerable advantage. On the tariff side, at least. And so I think there will have to be a means found to try and deal with these concerns. What the EU is offering on rules of origin is basically just the baseline of the pan Euro-Mediterranean Convention, which is very difficult, I think, for some clothing and textiles retailers in particular to make workable. There are also disputes still around conformity assessment, checking, certification, the issue of what markings would go on goods, which is really important for retail. Hopefully there could be a deal on that side as well. And I think the biggest opponent is the clock. You know, we're into a frantic 4 months. There's got to really be, I think, some progress by the end of this month. I think September, when you know, there's likely to be more capacity on the part of some of the other EU institutions, for example, the Council, now under German presidency for the next 6 months, to give a little political leadership on the tiller, I think that could be very useful in getting a deal over the line in time for ratification by the end of the year. But it's not just going to be about reaching a deal, it's about having a deal that can be implemented by business. And that's why we're watching very carefully what easements both sides might negotiate in terms of an adjustment period, and also what unilateral easements can be provided, such as those the UK government came up with on the 12th of June.
So speaking of frantic, the extension deadline is now passed. Exactly what does that mean to retailers, and how might any future relationship agreement between the UK and the EU look?
Well, the biggest consequence, and the thing that's got to be adjusted to very quickly, is that in 6 months' time, the UK will be leaving the single market, the customs union, and the common VAT area. You know, that is now set in stone. And so preparations really have to begin now. We know that the UK government will ask businesses to take some steps even before people go on their summer breaks at the end of July, and really throughout the period between now and January, in order to be ready. And this flows from the areas that myself and you know, other BRC colleagues have been raising with the UK government, that we know broadly what the shape on customs is going to be. We know broadly what the shape on VAT is going to be. So these are the areas where companies can take some steps now, even not in the full sight of the specific paperwork they'll be asked to fill out, but in terms of some of the things within their companies to get ready for import VAT, to get ready for customs declarations, because these things will happen regardless of what, if anything, is agreed in terms of the future relationship negotiations this summer and this autumn. So we've played an important part, I think, in helping feed into what's going to emerge from this comms campaign. But at every element of every part of every business, there is got to be a consideration of the goods which you import or export from to the European Union, what impact there's going to be on supply chains. Do your suppliers know about these enormous changes that are going to come on the 1st of January, some of them phased in? But are people prepared? And that is the biggest call, I think, that we have to make that comes from this decision not to extend the transition period. Businesses were years making preparations to enter the single market and have the removal of customs controls from 1993. There's going to be a fairly hard landing out of the single market and the customs union within just 6 months. So the scale of preparations must intensify both for UK retailers and those in the European Union.
So can we expect any clearer advice from the European Commission and the UK government in the near future in terms of, you know, what companies can do to prepare for the 1st of January?
Yes. I mean, our understanding is there's going to be a major communications campaign initiated by the UK government later this month. We're also expecting the publication of the UK's border operating model, which is meant to be the guidebook for how the GB border, anyway, will operate post 1st of January, post 1st of April, post 1st of July from next year. So that will provide a great deal of clarity and measures to be taken by UK retailers and other businesses. So the time is coming very quickly where some of the questions people have wanted answered will be answered. And the time is coming for really firm and decisive action amongst companies to get ready for these three deadlines fast approaching next year.
So moving on to other UK trade negotiations, how are those shaping up now that we're in the second half of 2020?
Well, there's a lot of activity going on. I mean, the clear priority is still, of course, trade deal continuity. There are some really important deals for UK retailers which have not been rolled over. They're not yet in a position to be implemented just for the UK from the 1st of January. So Mexico and Chile are amongst the most important, particularly on the agri-food side there. For clothing and textiles, of course, the Turkey customs union agreement with the EU is really vital. And I took part in a webinar this week with ministers from London and Ankara, in which this was discussed, and the importance of this to UK retail and UK consumers was made very clear. So that is tied together really with the EU negotiations. If there is a zero tariff deal with the EU, then it's very likely there's going to be a zero tariff deal with Turkey. If there isn't that zero tariff deal with the EU, then all bets are off in terms of what can be done with Turkey. So trade deal continuity really should be the priority, particularly for some of these major deals, as many as 20, which are not in a position still to apply to the UK on the 1st of January. And of course, a new deal is going to be added to that list with the EU's FTA with Vietnam, which is likely to come into force in early August and very much has preferences which will be advantageous for UK textiles and clothing retailers in offering quality products for consumers at attractive prices here. In terms of the other negotiations, you know, clearly the UK has set a path on reaching an FTA with the US. The progress is good, but I think one must look at the overall political context. You know, we have very bellicose noises still coming from Washington about the Airbus-Boeing dispute, which is likely to result in probably more tariffs on European goods, including UK goods, as we move towards the election date in America on the 4th of November. So relations between the EU and the US are not in a good place at the moment in terms of trade. So it does really look as if it is unlikely. And Ambassador Lighthizer, the US trade representative, told Congress a couple of weeks ago, very unlikely that there will be a deal reached with the UK this year, and certainly not before the election. And Liz Truss said she would you know, not take a bad deal over any deal in terms of these US negotiations. So the technical progress is good. We understand that on small businesses, they've effectively reached an agreement on a chapter for that. But the issue is going to be the electoral timetable and the very real prospect of a change of administration, possibly the Senate changing hands in the election in November too. And that means that the ratification process and agreement processes will be different. An incoming administration might want to prioritise trade relations with the EU and try and make those a little better rather than rushing to conclude an FTA with the UK. I think the real deadline for the UK on these negotiations is the USTR congressional authority, which runs out in the end of June in 2021. Really, if there is going to be a deal on the current mandate, it's got to be struck by that time. So I think that is a more realistic deadline rather than this year. In terms of the other negotiations with Australia, they begun this week. With New Zealand, they begin next week. Of course, the EU is involved in negotiations there. So in a sense, the UK is mirroring what the EU has begun. Also, the UK, once these bilateral deals are made, would want to accede to CPTPP, the 11-strong trading bloc in Asia Pacific. Interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, Liz Truss set out some other ambitions that she has, a kind of second wave of FTAs for India, the Gulf states, and Mercosur, Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, another area where the UK, where the EU has a deal in principle, but could have significant problems in getting it ratified. So we're beginning to see the parameters of where the UK wants to go. It wants to pivot to Asia Pacific. It wants to pivot to India. Sees these as important sources of growth in the future. But other trading blocs have the same idea. And of course, they have the, in the EU sense, the issue of scale, higher population, higher economic growth. So we'll see what both can achieve over the next few years.
Thanks, William. So Aidan, turning to you now, how much nearer are we getting to discovering what kinds of systems will be in place to deal with the goods movements between Great Britain and Northern Ireland from the 1st of January?
Well, firstly, can I ask William to tell us all that again, but in a little bit more detail? So
the same joke every time now, Aidan.
I know. It's either me or William needs to get better on new material. Am I allowed to talk about the leak that was in The Guardian this morning then, William? Is that now in public realm? Okay, let's have at it then. So the government has completely not listened to business, and they have put together a system which I will quickly run through here. But basically, firstly, to tell you what we had asked for. There's a key principle for this, that we've got very little time, and the fact that we have very little ability and capacity to deal with new systems, right? All this needs to be up, agreed, running, and it's not just for big retailers, it's about our supply chain as well. Everyone needs to be able to have these systems in place by the 1st of January. We were looking to see what we needed to do, what our responsibilities are. Now, some retailers, some of our supply chain are actually looking at the new processes and needing the detail of the new processes to see if their business model is going to be viable. What we had asked then was something along the lines of an off-the-shelf remedy for all of this, sort of an off-the-peg, something that is adding to or is quite similar to something that already exists, so that we could quite quickly get a hold of it. Because you've got to remember, even the biggest retailers here have never been exporters and importers of goods. We use other people to do that when it's stuff coming from EU to GB. But for us, now sending stuff from GB to NI, we are effectively exporting to Northern Ireland and importing to Northern Ireland. So that is where we are at the moment. So what we wanted was something like a trusted trader scheme, something like the AEO, which is, I've been told that I'm not allowed to speak in acronyms anymore. So AEO is Authorized Economic Operator. It is a scheme that's already out there. It has a burden of evidence. It has a long track record. We can use it to show dead end host. Dead end host is where something goes to Northern Ireland and it's not going any further. It doesn't go into the EU. So that's what we had asked for. What we got was not quite that. So that they basically, we were handed something that was a fair pump blue. It was ready to go. I believe the term is oven ready. Isn't that right, William?
Been used before.
Yes. I think we're going to need a bigger oven is just the way that we see it. So there's two main things on this, which is firstly the pre-lodgement model. And secondly is a temporary storage model. So the pre-lodgement model uses a new system developed by HMRC to carry out customs processes. The second is a temporary storage model, which is used in existing ports handling traffic from the rest of the world, right? Only one problem with that. That works very, very well if you have single commodities coming through. It also works very well if you have warehousing provision and that sort of thing. We don't. Quite simply, we have never had this before. The supply chains going to Northern Ireland are just in time. That means we don't have warehouses anymore. We have distribution centres. Things go to distribution centres and they're out the door within a few hours going to the stores. So the temporary storage model does not work for us. So if we look at the pre-lodgement model and this new system that's been developed by HMRC to carry out customs processes, what they are talking about, it's a GVMS, which is a Goods Vehicle Movement Service. So it's a new system to support the pre-lodgement model. Basically, what that looks like is that you have all your customs declarations and you input them. You have your import declaration, your safety and security, your CTC transport, and you input those into the system and it comes up with one number, which is your GMR number, your goods movement reference number. And you have that before boarding to prove that your goods have been pre-lodged with their declarations. That then what the only piece of paper that the haulier or the freight guy needs to get on the plane, train or automobile or truck. And then that goes, Her Majesty's government can do some risk assessed checks. There's an ability to audit this and it should be all good. However, what they've done is simply move the bottleneck, because you still need new software. You still need this new system to be in place. Very little time, remember, to do that. You also need for the computer systems that the retailers have. And remember, we've never done this before. So even the biggest retailers will have to get a new system. And it's still going to take all those man hours to put the import declaration, the safety and security declaration, CTC transit certificate into their unique reference numbers in to get that GMR, that goods movement reference. So you're not really removing friction. In fact, what you're doing is adding friction. It's easier for the haulier because they've got one reference number and you can see where it is. But this is basically just moving the bottleneck. There are still going to be costs. And remember, key position, as said every week, we are very low profit margin, high volume industry. If the new costs, should that be because of delays, manpower, systems, any of that stuff, is higher than the profit margin, then either the product or the business model will become unviable. Now, as well as that, for goods going from NI to the rest of the UK, gotta remember, we buy retailers buy about 2.6, 2.7 billion of Northern Ireland agri-food every year, as well as other products. And they will still have to put in reference numbers for CTC transit and their export declaration containing that security and safety information. Now, that's not exactly what the Prime Minister said in December last year when he said there will be no documents needed, and if you're asked for them, put them in the, send them to number 10 or put them in the bin. That's not quite what's happening. So there is still this GMR needs to be, goods movement reference still needs to be done for moving goods from NI to the rest of the UK. So that's where we are in broad terms of what the government is asking for us to do. Now, the other side of things that has to be remembered is that, again, we'll go back. I keep using these sort of, analogies. And the one that I use for this is the jigsaw. If you have one piece of the jigsaw, that's great, but it's not enough to make the whole picture. This new system does not deal with that. This new system does not deal with SPS, and that's sanitary and phytosanitary checks, which is the standards that we have that we will need to have on products of animal origin and that sort of thing. So this, firstly, creates a lot of paperwork. Secondly, it creates friction. Thirdly, it creates cost. Fourthly, it does not deal with VAT. And fifthly, it does not deal with SPS. Now, it does move the conversation along, and it is important to recognize this, that the government is now thinking about solutions. It is thinking about how to live up to its responsibilities under the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the withdrawal agreement. However, it doesn't work for business, and it doesn't, therefore, work for Northern Ireland consumers. We have half the discretionary income of GB households. If the costs go up, it either needs to get passed on by the consumer or the business model or the product doesn't work. So quite frankly, we are 2 steps forward, 3 steps back with this one, I feel.
Right. That's a lot to think about.
Sorry. Would you like me to say it again?
I was going to say, I thought you were the non-details guy. Okay. So moving on to the new coalition government in Ireland. So what impact will this new coalition have on these sorts of issues and the UK-EU future relationship overall?
Well, this is a really interesting dynamic because if you look at the last government, we had a Taoiseach who was, I won't use the word gung-ho, but he was quite strong. He was quite vociferous when it came to the defending Ireland's position within the EU and defending Northern Ireland, even Northern Ireland business, and even defending households here. You know, he made lots of trips up here to Northern Ireland, spoke to a lot of people. If you go down a level, the Taoiseach, Simon Coveney, and he was also the foreign minister, head of the DFA, the Department of Foreign Affairs, was very, very vocal, worked a lot with us. And then underneath him, we had, it's an offshoot of the Taoiseach's office, but it's the Minister for Foreign for European Affairs, and that was Helen McAtee. And she was really, really useful. Actually met with myself and Helen Dickinson, the Chief Executive of the British Retail Consortium, in Dublin, to listen to our concerns and to, you know, not just look at Brexit, but look at how we trade together and how retail is an important part of what we all do. So that's where we were. Then we had this sort of stagnation period, and it actually started last year before the elections. Remember, we've had the elections were earlier this year, but there was a certain amount of stagnation that was happening because people were building up to that inevitable election. A lot of people, a lot of commentators, I'll not mention Mr. Hodges' name, have been saying that the reason that Leo didn't get a majority, Leo Varadkar, the Irish Taoiseach, didn't get a Varadkar, was because of Brexit. That's absolutely nothing to do with it. Brexit did not play a big part in the southern elections at all. It was about health, it was about housing, it was about education, it was about national usual politics rather than that foreign aspect. And I think people who have sort of blown that out of all sort of proportion and looking to point the Brexit picture, the Brexit finger. I think the funniest one was the Daily Express, who said that he had been booted out when actually he's in the coalition government. He's going to be Taoiseach again in 2 years. So please do your homework before you write a headline. So that stagnation that was there was basically because it was a run-up to election. Then we were dealing with the civil servants rather than the ministers. The ministers couldn't actually do anything outside of their mandate. They couldn't push through anything new, quite simply because they didn't have the mandate to do it. There was no government that had been decided. Now we are back in. We have a new team. Still waiting to find out who the Minister for European Affairs is, but the Taoiseach is Leo Varadkar. The new Taoiseach is Micheál Martin for Fianna Fáil. The Taoiseach, that's the Deputy Prime Minister, is Leo Varadkar. So quite a steady hand at the tiller. More importantly for us is the fact that the Foreign Minister, they've split Taoiseach and Foreign Minister in two now, and the Foreign Minister continues to be Simon Coveney. That means that we can expect that there will be a steady hand at the tiller, that there will not be any sort of major policy change in the Brexit front from the south of Ireland. I think that what we have seen so far, even in this past week or so, is that they're very much towing the EU party line. And I think if you look at how the government has reacted over this past few years, it has gone very strong, then come back to the EU party line, gone very strong, come back to the EU party line. And I think that's the sort of thing that we could see happening. Again, as soon as it was announced last weekend, I wrote to Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, the Foreign Minister, and the prospective Minister for European Affairs. So I'm hopeful that, firstly, as the Northern Ireland Brexit Business Brexit Working Group Chair, But secondly, as far as our members, that we are going to get some sort of communication with them and some sort of dialogue with them in this very next short wee while. Other than that, just to say that there's a new Senate in place as well, and there are new committees. And I think one of the things that we will be looking to do over the next wee while is to ramp up what we're doing in the Republic of Ireland as well as in Northern Ireland, to make them understand that an FTA, free trade agreement, very important for them, both in the amount of goods that they bring in from British supermarkets to the Republic of Ireland, but also if you look at those exports, that would be, not to be stereotypical, but actually potatoes is a big export, beef, cheese, and then beer. These are huge export markets from the Republic of Ireland to GB, and that's why, you know, there is a certain amount of latitude. What we've always said in the NARC and BRC is that because of the integrated nature of supply chains across the islands, we need this to work. And to do that now, we need that FTA that William was talking about earlier on.
Absolutely. So, William, just before we wrap up, one more question for you. Ireland's EU Commissioner Phil Hogan has now pulled out of the race to become the WTO's new Director General. Who now looks like the front runner in this post? And was him pulling out because of lack of support or a busy workload for the new Commission on Trade Policy? What was going on there?
I think a mixture of both, actually. So the process is likely to go on until December. Perhaps conveniently after the date of the US presidential election. So it may be a bit easier to find a full-time head of the World Trade Organization.
Is there any truth to the rumor that you're in for it, William?
Oh, no.
There's been whispers.
There have, yes.
If nominated, I would decline the old saying from the US. Really a mixture of both. This process is going to go on until December. Unlikely the US would approve any nominee before that stage. The EU does have a lot of trade work on its plate post-COVID-19, this initial outbreak. And I think the sense was that looking at where some of the support was coalescing from other parts of the world, that it might be prudent for the EU not to advance a candidate of its own at this stage. So 2 points, really. I think the front runner, I would say, is Nigeria's former finance and foreign minister, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who has been very well supported by Africa, has extensive World Bank experience as well, has both political and economic experience. And I think she would be a very strong candidate in what's a very difficult period for the WTO. You know, we have seen through the course of the COVID-19 outbreak, countries begin to bring in protectionist measures, whether it's export bans, taxes on goods leaving, supply chains globally have become a little bit weaker over the course of the COVID outbreak. And of course, you've also got countries rejecting international institutions as the best means of trying to resolve trade disputes and acting on their own, whether it's America first or other countries acting alone. And so there's a big job for the WTO to help put this system back together. A rules-based trading system is good for trade. It lowers prices for consumers. It gives consumers more choice. It allows for the fair working of trade rules, and that is to everyone's benefit. But moreover, we need a WTO leadership which is going to build and drive digital trade, one of the areas that we've seen rise massively as a result of this outbreak. And the real measures on digital trade are going to be taken at the WTO. So that's going to be a priority for the next head of that organisation. And that will have direct relevance to what retailers are doing in the future in the UK. In terms of the EU's agenda, yes, it is very packed. And this is one of the reasons why Phil Hogan wants to stay in post to help drive this through. The EU has a new approach, open strategic autonomy, it's called, which is really twofold. One, to, in some cases, diversify supply chains to ensure perhaps that the EU is not as dependent on the future on countries like India for supplies of paracetamol or ibuprofen, similar problem that we in the UK had this year as well. So there will be some, you know, diversifying of supply chains involved. But I think also, and this is in part because of what's going on in the US, the EU is looking to be more muscular in terms of exporting its values, its standards, and defending its businesses from arbitrary tariffs, such as may come from the United States later this summer. And so it's looking at its trade defence toolbox to try and see how European companies can be protected, whilst at the same time being open to lowering tariffs through trade deals and other measures with other countries. So it's a big agenda, and the EU is very keen on integrating the sustainability agenda, the green agenda, the digital agenda into its trade policy. Now, why is this of relevance to the UK? Well, one, the EU is the UK's biggest trading partner. So what happens there has enormous cut across to what our trade links will be with the EU. And also, I think, as an example of what can be done in terms of where trade policy is going. So the EU has launched a major EU trade policy review. That's something which retail and the BRC has called for in the United Kingdom. And so once the immediate crisis has abated, once all of these rollover trade agreements have been put in place, the other negotiations that the UK government's involved with, it's useful to have a strategic view about where the UK's trade policy is going. Where does UK trade sit in the world? Is it going to perhaps favour manufacturers a little more, as some of the language about levelling up might presuppose? Or is it going to go in a more consumer direction, looking at lowering costs, more trade facilitations, more measures that would be welcomed by the retail industry and by the consumers that it serves? So there are big decisions to be made about trade policy, decisions with consequences, and we're urging the government to begin to address these questions as soon as possible for consumers' benefit.
Great. And that's where we're going to leave the discussion for today. Extremely busy times ahead for everyone. So thank you, William, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also a big thank you to you, Aidan.
You're welcome.
And if you'd like to find out anything else about trade and British retail, you can visit us at brc.org.uk. Otherwise, bye for now.